the opera makes clear, are afraid to be strong. Some of them actually find they don't like the architecture in this new world. And most interestingly, many of them find the air to be too thin. They can't bear the lightness of breath, as it's called in the opera, and they commit suicide. Now, in the end, the purpose of this opera is meant to convey something optimistic. It's about the possibility of a new future. And yet, when one reads it, when one watches it, as people did in this park in Petersburg, one finds there's another theme. It's not the only theme. And in this work is really emblematic of the time, this same sort of uncertainty, this same sort of joyful horror that Bloch described. As always, there's contradiction, there's doubt, there's uncertainty, there's hope, there's joy, and there's horror. Can all be found in futurism, as in so much decadent literature, so much everyday culture of the time as well. And we find this same uncertainty, this same joyful horror, in the other major cultural trend of these years, the last one I talk about before we turn to the war, the massive cultural and spiritual renaissance, known as a religious upheaval, the subject of the next lecture.
Lecture 24, Fin de siècle culture, the religious renaissance.
We continue in this lecture looking at one of the most critical and fascinating and fateful periods in Russian history, the so-called fin de siècle, the end of the age, especially between 1905 and 1914, but in many ways also including the turn of the century and the early years of the 20th century. A time when, as we've seen, can be seen to be a time of both looming crisis and also when many people felt great new possibility, great new hope for the future. At the heart of both sides of this period, of both crisis and possibility, was religion. Religion and, more broadly, spirituality. And that's the subject of this lecture. In these years, beginning roughly around the 1890s and especially intensifying after 1905, Russia experienced what was already beginning to be called then a religious renaissance. Much of this took place outside the established church, outside its structures and control, and sometimes even opposed to the established Russian Orthodox Church. In many ways, in fact, one might say that the term religious renaissance is too feeble to describe the real passionate and often troubled nature of this spiritual ferment in Russia in these years. And perhaps a better attempt to capture the spirit of this religious renaissance was offered by the poet Alexander Bloch, writing in 1908, when he says what was really happening in Russia at the time was an upheaval of the elemental, he said, an upheaval of emotion and fear and fury and deep spiritual searching through, as he put it, the crusted lava of civilization, an upheaval of all of these passions through what had become the westernized, civilized nature of Russia, its Philistinism, as futurists would say. Now, before turning to the many expressions of this intense, passionate, religious searching and innovation in these years, it's necessary to say something a little more than I have about the nature of Russian Orthodoxy itself, the dominant faith in Russia of the majority of its people, and also the official religion of the state itself, something about Orthodoxy's distinctive spiritual culture. This is obviously a huge topic, to say the essence of what a religion is, and it's not to be simplified. But what I'd like to do for clarity is to emphasize one essential characteristic, what has been called sometimes Orthodoxy's sacramental mysticism. First, a brief terminological issue. The English word we use, orthodoxy, a term which generally means correct thinking, a correct doctrine, is in fact not the best translation of what the Russians call their religion, which is pravoslavia, And pravoslavia means not correct thinking or correct doctrine, but the correct way of worshiping, literally the correct way to glorify God. In other words, it's less about doctrine and ideas than it is about worship, about ceremony. And a good starting point for understanding this religion is a rather revealing legend from one of the oldest known Russian texts, a text known as the Russian Primary Chronicle, though the actual Russian title of it is in translation, The Tale of Bygone Years. This text, still widely read and known by every Russian well into the 20th century, tells the story of the decision in the late 10th century by the Grand Prince Vladimir, who ruled Russia at the time, to accept Christianity and to insist on the mandatory baptism of the whole Russian people, who were then what would be called pagans. It was decided that for diplomatic reasons, for economic reasons, Russia needed to adapt one of the religions of the major empires of the world that it had dealings with. So Vladimir sent his emissaries off to check out the various religions. To look at Islam, he went to the Bulgars, who were living in Russia's Volga region, who were Muslim. He sent an emissary to what the Russians like to call the Germans, which meant the Catholic Holy Roman Empire, and emissaries to Constantinople, the center of the Byzantine eastern branch of the church. And the chronicles describe, and every Russian knows this phrase, it is so central to how they think about their own religion, describes the reaction of these emissaries in the 10th century in Constantinople. They were, it said, dazzled by the glory and the beauty of the church and by its ceremonies. And they came back and they told Vladimir the following: "We knew not whether we were in heaven or on earth. For on earth there is no such splendor or beauty, and we are at a loss how to describe it. We only know that God dwells there among men." And this story, even if it's made up, indeed, especially if it's made up, is wonderfully revealing about the nature of orthodoxy, about the centrality of beauty and feeling. And one way to describe this, this emphasis on beauty and feeling is with the term that's sometimes used, the mysticism of the sacrament. And of course, the term sacrament refers to the various analogies to Christ's declaration to his disciples at the Last Supper that the bread and wine that he was serving was his body and his blood. In other words, this notion that in physical objects exists the sacred. This is what the sacrament is all about. In Orthodox practice, this ideal, this sacramental mysticism, is evident all over. It's evident in the frescoes and the mosaics and the icons that cover every wall already of a Greek church and then, of course, of the later Russian churches. And these images were seen not just as images of the divine world, but as I've said, their actual presence on earth, their physicalness. The gorgeous services of Russian Orthodoxy similarly convey this presence of the sacred. One sees it in the chanting, glorious singing, in the incense, in sacred words and gestures, and the whole liturgy is meant to suggest this physical presence of the divine. One sees it in Orthodoxy's sense of the sacred in the plenitude of objects, in wine, in water, in oil, in bread, and for many peasants, as especially in homes and in the fields and in the pasture lands, in nature itself. We see it also in the physicality of prayer, in the activeness of physical prayer, where Russians are standing, but also bowing and kneeling and going up to icons and kissing them and crossing themselves regularly. All of these practices were efforts to create what the emissaries to Constantinople called heaven on earth, to make the divine manifest in physical things. And this emphasis on the sacramental that is so central to Orthodoxy can be seen also in its lesser stress, compared especially to the Latin Church, on the historical Christ and his teachings. For most Orthodox, indeed for the Church itself, the Gospel was above all a book of mysteries, a book of sacred words and guides for a spiritual life, much more than a guide for an ethical life. It was a work of mystery. Now, as you'll see, I think, all of these currents of Russia's, all of the currents that I'm about to describe of Russia's religious Renaissance at the turn of the century and the early 20th century can be seen in different ways of it being in a conversation with this established orthodoxy, echoing it, sometimes arguing with it. Partly this religious renaissance, as you'll see, was a critique of the muted attention to ideas, to ethics, to values in orthodoxy. We saw this already with Tolstoy. But also for many, this was an attempt to recover that intense spiritual feeling that many felt the church had forgotten, that rituals seemed to become only rituals and the passion seemed to be missing. Now this renaissance, this upheaval of the elemental, as Bloch called it, took many forms. First and most notably, we see it among Russia's intellectuals in the form of widespread mysticism and religious searching. And a very major influence here, widely read among educated Russians, was a philosopher and also a poet named Vladimir Solovyov, and especially his writings of the 1890s. And in these, and they're very dense and complex, certain key ideas stand out. One of these was his idea, very influential in these later years, called all unity. All unity. A mystical ideal of the connectedness, the unity of all things. In a lot of ways, if you remember back to the Slavophiles, this echoes their own ideas about the connectedness of all things, their ideas about linkages, a characteristic of Russian culture. Most important, though, for thinkers in the late, for educated Russians reading Solovyov and for Solovyov in the late 19th century, this idea of all unity was about Russia leading the whole world beyond the limitations of Western civilization, which was, as they saw it, too mechanical and too fractured. It lost a sense of the wholeness of all things, leading the world, in other words, toward one world culture united by one united Christian faith. Unity was a central idea and very influential. An even more influential idea by Solovyov was his idea of God-manhood. One word, God-manhood. For Solovyov, the essence of Christianity, and interestingly enough, he said, of the Eastern religions, which he admired, was, he said, mystical. The heart of Christianity was its mysticism. And the key mystical moment in the emergence of Christianity was the appearance of Christ in the world. In other words, the moment when God was made into a man, God-man. And this unity of God and man was said to be the ultimate unity in the world, the unity that was at the heart of the world. And Solovyov argued, and many followed him in this, it was prophetic. It pointed to where human history was heading, toward the unity of all things, all unity that I've discussed, including spiritual and material things, but also toward what was so important to Solovyov, toward human perfection, toward man, human beings becoming more like God, toward God-manhood. Closely related to this idea, and again, very influential, people, Russians at the time were very excited to talk about these ideas, was an idea that is even more complicated, but even more popular, the idea of Sophia. This idea of divine wisdom personified as a woman. And Solovyov got this idea of feminine divine wisdom from a variety of sources. He got it from the Old Testament. Proverbs 8 to 9 in particular talk about a wisdom, which in the Greek is Sophia, appears as a female figure and is said to exist before God made the world. He adopted it from Jewish mystical writings, the Kabbalah, which he read and found very suggestive. He drew this idea of Sophia from 17th century European philosophers of religion and most importantly from the Russian Orthodox tradition. Many early Russian churches, for example, in the city of Novgorod, but before that in Kiev, were devoted to Sophia, as was, in fact, of course, the main cathedral in Hagia Sophia. The main cathedral of Hagia Sophia in Constantinople was about Sophia. For Solovyov, this idea of Sophia represented more than just wisdom, and indeed to many of his readers. It was the incarnation of this great idea of unity. She was, he wrote, God's word, that is to say wisdom, made flesh, and pointed to where humanity's going, toward perfection. Now, all of this may seem vague and often difficult to comprehend. What's important to understand is how excited Russians were by these ideas, and especially by their fundamental spirit, that history was about the moving toward greater spiritual perfection and unity in the world, and indeed that the meaning of the world was to be found in deeper and more complex spirituality and mysticism. In the years after 1905, this sort of mystical and spiritual idealism became increasingly pervasive in Russian life, especially among the educated. In fact, so pervasive was it that many contemporaries spoke of a mass movement, especially among the educated, that they called God-seeking, Bogoiskatelstvo in Russian. This movement of God-seeking involved huge numbers of Russians reading and talking about spiritual questions, including, as you know, in the court of Nicholas and Alexandra themselves. Huge numbers of Russians talked about religion, read the works of Solovyov and other philosophers, attended discussions in various public or civic organizations, circles and clubs and organizations, often featured talks about the meaning of life from a spiritual point of view. This was all described as God-seeking. This movement was a desire for a spiritual meaning in the world, but it was also a sign of the crisis of the times that we've seen so much evidence of. This turn to religious, searching for religious meaning also reflected people's anxieties about the dark sides of modern life, such as we've seen. Their profound dissatisfaction with the nature of the modern world in which at least educated Russians increasingly were living, a world of science, a world of rationalism. How to explain, Russians asked, the suffering around them? How to know that this would all lead to some greater happiness, to redemption? Rationalism and science didn't seem to hold the answers religion, spirituality, did. And of course, it also reflected a widely expressed discontent with the established church. Seemed to fit into the life of the state, to defend the state, but had forgotten how to inspire the people with religious feeling and meaning. Now, in this movement, this God-seeking movement, one sees a huge variety of trends. Some, by the way, influenced by things going on in Western Europe, some of them influencing Western Europe itself. For example, many intellectuals spent a lot of time talking about the need to reemphasize ethics and their religious roots in guiding how life should be organized, where Russia should go. Some people, for example, were very interested in what were called neo-Kantian ethics, the ideal that there existed in the world, universals, ethical imperatives, above all, the duty to respect human beings, an idea we've seen so often, ethical imperatives which were argued were rooted in the very nature of the human mind. This was neo-Kantianism. Very influential, similarly ethical, was Tolstoyanism, which attracted many followers before his death in 1910 and after. These Tolstoyans were inspired by Tolstoy's promotion of an ethic of Christian living, simple living, of love. And like them, they rejected the need for priests and sacraments and liturgy in favor of a personal understanding of God and a focus on ethical living. Many others, though, were more likely to emphasize mysticism. Movements with names like theosophy and anthroposophy and various other currents of spirituality, or what some have called the occult, were very popular, including astrology and seances, as in Western Europe at the time. And these spiritual seekers were seeking somehow to re-enchant the world, to see the invisible world, the mysteries of the world that lay beyond and beneath and behind the material life that seemed to be so present. Many turned to Eastern religions. Hinduism, Buddhism became quite fascinating to many. And many began to talk about the times they were living in as best described in the book of Revelation, as about a coming apocalypse. And this became a subject of much discussion. Amazingly, even Marxists, in particular the most radical Marxists, those who followed Lenin's Bolshevism, were, to Lenin's great horror, affected by all this religious and spiritual searching. In fact, in particular, a very influential group of Marxists, including the very influential and popular writer Maxim Gorky and the future Commissar of Education in the Soviet government, a man named Anatoly Lunacharsky, began talking in the years after 1905 about the need to bring a religious spirit, religious feeling to Marxism itself. They said the trouble with Marxism is it's too cold. It's too rationalistic. It's too scientific. What it needs to do is do for people what religion does. Give them a sense of passion, of wonderment, of moral certainty. Connect politics with the inner life, with the inner soul. And most importantly, offer a sure promise of deliverance from evil and even from death. And they called this socialist religious viewpoint or argument or movement God building, a sort of answer to larger God seeking. It wasn't about finding God. God didn't exist, the Marxists said. It was about creating God. Now, what I've described so far occurred largely outside the church, even opposed to it. The church, too, was changing in these years. For example, individual priests often joined intellectuals in various public discussions of religion and spirituality. Some clergy began to talk about the need to free the church from excessive state control, to replace the synod in particular by their own patriarch, a post that hadn't existed since Peter the Great abandoned it and abolished it. Finally, some priests began to innovate in tradition in a way in common with the God-seeking movement of the time. The most notable of these was the very popular priest, Father John of Kronstadt, being an island not far from St. Petersburg. For Father John, who attracted thousands of followers from all over the country, it was essential to get back to Orthodox spirituality. Something had been lost, he argued. And he encouraged his parishioners and those who came on pilgrimage to him not to just passively attend church, as it seemed to him many were doing, but to partake in with passion in the sacraments, in particular in communion and confession. In fact, many Russians began to view Father John as a saint. Even some spoke of him as Christ himself returned to earth to bring the church alive. Now, these movements of God-seeking and God-building that I've described are mainly among the educated. And yet there was also a popular, a lower-class version of this same religious renaissance. We see, for example, beginning in the 1890s, a growth of Tolstoyan communities among poor people in cities and in the countryside. We see growing attraction to various non-conformist religious groups that the church considered to be sects. Groups with names like Free Christians or the Wailers or the Sons of the Apocalypse, but also older Russian sects that had existed sometimes since the 18th century, such as the very famous Skoptsi, a word that indicates what they did to seek God, and that was to castrate themselves, all about seeking religious truth, religious passion. We see popularity of Baptists, growing Protestant denominations who emphasized a personal faith, and various followers of individual mystics and healers. In Moscow and St. Petersburg especially, again in the years especially after 1905, thousands of workers, artisans, and others began to flock to hear nonconformist religious preachers, people who preach sobriety, self-respect, the nurturing of an inner life. They called, for example, on people to live with the dignity that befits human beings as embodying the Holy Spirit. And they reminded the poor, which helped make them popular, that the poor shall inherit the earth. For example, one of these movements was known as the Brethren, and it grew so large that the church actually had to arrest and excommunicate its preachers in 1912. And the Brethren were effective, and they're typical of many of these popular movements, not just because of their message about the poor inheriting the earth or the need to live with dignity, but also typically of the time with their tone and style. It was said that they spoke in a very simple and direct language with real sympathy and understanding for the sufferings of the poor who came to their meetings. Most important, it was said they had deep spiritual passion, unlike the dry ritualism and preaching in the established church. To give one example, a participant observed, "In the churches, they instruct the common people with orthodox teachings, which are absorbed like any teaching by the mind, but leave people's feelings untouched. Brother Ivan," that's the leader of the movement in Moscow, "knew how to set fire to the emotions." This is, of course, what orthodoxy was supposed to do. Many felt it no longer did. And these meetings of the Brethren were very exultant, a sort of atmosphere of revival. The congregation stood up and shouted. interrupting the preaching. Songs were sung. The parishioners repeated the preacher's words quite often. It was very intense and passionate, even though increasingly not Orthodox. The same thing was going on in the villages, it turns out. Though deeply religious, here too one sees a type of revival, a type of God-seeking. Many began to read, those who were literate or could read to others, spiritual and ethical literature that began to appear. Many began to associate with these various nonconformist religious movement, cults, as they were often described by the church. We see an upsurge in pilgrimage to holy sites. We see an upsurge in devotion to miraculous icons. We see growing claims of miraculous healings in these years. We hear of increasing numbers of miraculous visitations by the Virgin Mary as well, by the Mother of God. Now, we see reflections of all of this spiritual searching also in the art and literature of the times, where there's enormous nonconformist searching for spiritual meaning. We see this in literature, particularly in the most influential movement in these years, what was called a symbolism. And the symbolism shared the general discontent with rationalism and positivism, with science and materialism. For symbolists, the things of the physical world weren't real in themselves, but were correspondences, signs of higher realities, windows through which one might catch a glimpse of the other, higher, truer world. At the same time, and characteristic of this religious renaissance as well, the symbolist writers often had very dark images in their poems and stories, a sort of foreboding. One was, of course, constant discussion of the apocalypse. Images of the apocalypse kept appearing in popular, in symbolist writings of these years. Images inspired by the Book of Revelation, but often quite elaborate and reimagined. Much symbolist writing, in fact, is filled with literal images of some sort of coming apocalyptic disaster, out of which it was suggested perhaps would come salvation. A lot of this writing, though, is simply dark. It's about shadows and specters and devils and evil and chaos and a great deal of death, similar in some ways to the decadent literature we've talked about. These moods were common among intellectuals, but in fact even working class writers who I've introduced before, were affected by these contradictory moods, these anxieties and hopes. For example, one worker poet expressed a rather common sentiment when he said he was living in his words, the depths of melancholy, longing, and emptiness, but also that he was certain that the miracle of goodness would bring a new world free of suffering and oppression. Very similar to the and parallel to the same sort of spiritual searching for meaning and hope in the face of despair. We see the same thing in the visual arts. And the best example of this is in the work, again, of Kazimir Malevich. Consider, to give the essence of this, two characteristic images, both painted just on the eve of the war. The most famous is a painting called Black Square, which he painted repeatedly on the eve of the war and after. It functioned in many ways like an icon itself, though it was nothing more than a black square on a white background. Here was, in Malevich's eyes and in those of many who went and saw this painting, a window into that other world that everybody was seeking beyond matter and reason. Here was a space that was like an icon that contained the presence of some greater power beyond the everyday worldly powers and reasoning. And in fact, this way in which this painting, this simple painting of a black square on a white background, was seen to be as powerful as an icon can be seen in Malevich's own view when he set up this famous exhibition that I mentioned before of his paintings in 1915 in Petrograd. Well, the paintings had been mostly done just before the war, and he took the black square and he placed it in the corner, the upper corner of the room, the same place where a traditional believer would place an icon. It was, to him, an icon with the same sorts of power, the same way of suggesting how one could find deeper, more secret, more mysterious truths through images such as this, like an icon. Perhaps even more telling is that he repeatedly came back to the image of the cross. And crosses appear in his paintings, they appear in other people's paintings, they appear in poetry of the time, in stories of the time. The image of the cross was extremely central to this religious renaissance. For Malevich, the cross, indeed for many and most Russians at the time, the cross, obviously an echo of Golgotha, of the place where Christ was crucified, was to him and to so many a symbol of the central contradiction of life itself, and certainly of the Russian situation on the eve of the war. Profound suffering, profound crisis, but also the promise of redemption, even resurrection. This is what the cross was meant to symbolize, both suffering and the promise of solution. Malevich also, like many paintings of the painters of the time, used colors in a symbolic way, especially in these crosses. In fact, all colors on an icon were meant to be symbolic. Each one, a viewer knew the special and secret meanings of iconic colors. And the same is true for Malevich's paintings. Above all, he favored two colors that are central to Russian culture in many ways, red and black. Red is the symbol of suffering, of Christ's blood, but it's also the symbol of salvation and indeed of beauty. The Russian word red is also the Russian word for beauty in Old Russian. And black, a symbol of darkness, of emptiness, but also a symbol of openness, of potential, of possibility. And again, we see in these visual images the sort of characteristic ambiguity that characterizes this whole religious renaissance and in some ways the whole situation of Russia on the eve of the war. This ambiguity that one sees here, even in a simple painting of a cross or of a black square, suited the time as well. The religious renaissance that I've been describing of these years was about finding meaning, preferably certain meaning, answers to the problems of life in general, of which there were many, and certainly the problems of Russian life. But it was also, this religious renaissance, was also an expression, as you've seen, of feeling, and indeed a contradictory feeling, of desire and hope for escape from the hardships of life, desire for salvation, but also an expression of longing and emptiness and fear and suffering. Feelings that gave meaning to the world, but did not necessarily give certainty about where the world was heading. And of course, the way so many Russians at the time talked about apocalypse was characteristic. A coming catastrophe, an apocalypse, seemed certain to so many Russians in all classes. Whether this apocalypse would be followed, as the Christian apocalypse should be, by redemption and salvation was not so sure. Next time, we'll talk about a time in which many believed the apocalypse had indeed come. The horrors of World War I and the upheavals that brought down the monarchy and indeed so much of the old order of Russia.
This audiobook has been broken into multiple parts to make the download faster. You have reached the end of a part, but not the end of the complete audiobook. So please check your library for the next part of this audiobook.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.
This is Audible.
These lectures are part of the Great Courses series. They are produced by The Teaching Company. These lectures are titled, A History of Russia, From Peter the Great to Gorbachev, Part 3. Lecture 25, War and Revolution.
As we've already seen several times, wars are truly moments of truth for Russia. Moments when the empire and its politics were often shaped, especially during the wars of Peter the First and Catherine the Second, but also moments, especially during defeats such as the Crimean War, when the weaknesses of the empire and of its politics became plain, often leading, as we've seen, to reforms. In this lecture, we look at the Russian experience during another time of war, in this case, what became known later as World War I, then was simply the Great War, or the World War. But World War I was like no other war Russia had ever seen. This was a protracted war, a modern war fought against highly developed industrial powers, Germany and Austria. And this also meant, as a result, as everywhere else in Europe, extensive mobilization to fight this long and modern war. Mobilization not just of the army, but of society and the economy as well. Russia had never experienced anything so trying as this war. And every weaknesses that we've seen already emerging in its society, in its political structure, and its economy, now became critical threats to survival. At first, in fact, it's worth saying that the war was a pretty good thing for Russia. As in a lot of countries in Europe, in August 1914, when the war broke out, going to war took people's minds off the various concerns and problems and worries that we'd seen became so characteristic of late imperial Russia on the eve of the war. In fact, it's worth saying that the war actually united large numbers of people, had them forget their discontents, unite around the government against an external enemy, an aggressive external enemy, especially Germany. In fact, large numbers of Russians participated in great anti-German demonstrations in the streets of the major Russian cities, and even engaged in violent riots against individual Germans, Germans who owned factories, for example, Germans who owned stores, even stores that had names on it that seemed to suggest that a German might own it. But this patriotic enthusiasm, though it was far from universal, plenty of people found it difficult to unite even against Germany in this war. This patriotic enthusiasm that was fairly common didn't last long. Before very long, people began to speak of the war as nothing less than a catastrophe for a number of reasons. First of all, conditions on the battlefields, the trenches at the front, were horrible. Adding to the ordinary hardships of war, the ordinary hardships of being in the Russian army, in which conditions were always notoriously bad for ordinary soldiers, the supply situation for soldiers at the front got worse and worse very quickly as the war began. The army very quickly ran short of rifles, of ammunition, of uniforms, and, of course, increasingly, of food. In fact, it was so bad that by the middle of 1915, men were being sent out to the front without rifles at all. They were told rather gruesomely, "Don't worry, there are plenty of dead men lying in the field. Pick up their rifles, load up with their ammunition." As this suggests, it was the human losses of the war that were really most devastating. In fact, already by the end of 1914, only 5 months into the war, nearly 400,000 Russian men had lost their lives, and 1 million were injured. By 1916, 3 million Russians were dead or wounded, and nearly as many were captured. With good reason, many soldiers in the Russian army during the war felt, and in fact began increasingly publicly and among, as well as among themselves, to say so, that they were treated by their government not as men, not even as valuable warriors, but simply as raw material to be squandered by the rich and the powerful who sat back home. On top of all this, by the spring of 1915, the army was in steady and often extremely chaotic retreat. Still, wasn't all bad. By 1916, the military situation in some ways improved. Russian troops ceased retreating, managed to hold their own. There were even a few modest successes in offensive staged in the war during 1916, though at great loss of life. These were especially successes against Austria as well as Turkey, which had joined the Central Powers. And most impressively, Russia was able to hold Germany off at least at a steady level, forcing Germany to fight a two-front war, which many have argued is an important reason that Germany ultimately lost. Also, the problem of shortages in many ways got less severe in the course of 1916. A major effort to improve domestic production launched by the state and in some ways supported by leading industrialists forming organizations to advance military production began to provide more weapons to the front, better supplies and food. And it's worth noting this was an entirely a Russian effort. Though the Allies tried to help with supplies, France and England, that is, because of the blockaded Baltic and the blockaded Black Seas, there was no way to get supplies to the Russians. But they solved the problems gradually and increasingly on their own. Nevertheless, even in 1916, though the military situation had gotten better, the morale among soldiers continued, by all accounts, to decline. The fortunes of war may have improved, but the facts of war for an ordinary soldier remained. Horrible losses, terrible conditions at the front and at home, and increasing doubts as why they were fighting this war at all. In fact, it's on the home front where suffering was almost as severe, and soldiers were aware of this and often thought, what's going back home with my families? In fact, by the end of 1915, there were plentiful indications that the economy was breaking down under the heightened strain of wartime mobilization. Fuel and raw materials in particular were increasingly scarce and often affecting production. Productivity was falling in large numbers of industries, especially non-military industries, which were providing the supplies that people needed for their everyday life. Partly the problem was that large numbers of unskilled workers were entering industry as existing workers were drafted and sent to the front, and also as the demands of increasing production required more workers in industry overall. Food supplies, most seriously, for the point of view of most ordinary citizens of Russian cities, food supplies were falling, partly due to disastrous transportation problems, never strong before the war, but made worse by the mobilization of transportation for war purposes. But also, the food situation was made worse by the tendency of peasants, rather typical in the course of a war, to hoard grain. Since inflation was rendering their money worthless, they decided, we'll just hang on to this grain until things get better. This inflation was also itself a major problem. Prices of food and commodities kept rising in the course of the war due to shortages. And all of these economic conditions together combined to create increasing suffering back in the home front, especially among the urban poor and the middle classes, those with the least to fall back on. Inflation was pressing down real wages, and even for those wealthy enough to have savings but not wealthy enough to survive under any conditions, for the middle classes, savings became less and less valuable. All of this was made worse, especially for urban workers, including white-collar workers, by a periodic loss of wages due to shortages of raw materials. If you were in a factory, shortages of fuel to even keep the place warm and keep the lights running. Thousands were regularly idled because there simply wasn't raw material or fuel for especially factories. Food shortages were the most visible sign creating problems in the city, leading to long lines outside bakeries, outside food stores, long lines that were especially brutal during the Russian winter. Adding to all this, there was a widespread and troubling disruption of family life. Men were sent to the front. Women and children were sent to the factories. Everything seemed to be disordered for people. Suffering was particularly bad, ironically, dangerously, in the capital. Petrograd, as St. Petersburg became patriotically renamed. In this city, shops often closed early because they had nothing to sell. Bread stores shut early because there was no bread, there was no sugar, there was no meat, there were no provisions. Shops closed. Lines grew for what remained at the few stores that remained open, and people would rush early in the morning in the often dark and cold of winter to wait for what few goods likely existed in stores. Due to inflation and shortages, it also became increasingly difficult to afford, for especially urban lower-class Russians, the prices of what existed in these shops, which wasn't much. And many people were turned to various desperate measures, not able to afford coal or even the wood that would be sold to keep the stoves in people's homes warm, again, especially during the winter, which is long in Russia. They began to tear down wooden fences, tear wood off the outside of buildings just to keep warm. Large numbers of Russians could be seen during the war in the capital city itself, begging just to get by, and large numbers of women turned to prostitution, and many men as well as women turned to crime. Anything to survive in these horrible conditions. Adding to all these problems were the political decisions made by the Tsar and his government. At this time of unprecedented national crisis, the Tsar refused repeated appeals by liberals to involve citizens in policy as participants in some way in government by choosing leading officials, leading members of civil society, perhaps for his cabinet, at least for his advisors. Instead, fairly typically, Nicholas retreated further and further into his personalized ideal of rulership, the notion that he alone knew best what was right for his people. He didn't need to hear the advice of anybody, save, of course, God. And a symbol of this whole approach was his decision in the summer of 1915, as we've mentioned before, to take personal command of the army. It's worth noting that most of his ministers advised him that this would not be a good idea. He should stay in the capital. He shouldn't be the commander-in-chief of the army. But Nicholas, as you know, was convinced that his presence would inspire the troops in the way that no other leader could and lead to certain victory. And this decision had two very important consequences. One, it associated Nicholas personally with Russia's poor performance at the front. No longer could anyone say, the Tsar is far away, he doesn't know how bad it is. He had to be seen now as personally responsible for when things were not going well at the front, even when it was only a stalemate. Also, and in the eyes of many Russians, this was far worse, by leaving the capital, he gave a great deal of real, everyday political power to two people, to his wife, Alexandra, and many Russians were beginning to refer to her as the German Empress, given where she was born, and begin to question her loyalty. After all, she had family ties to the German government itself. And the other person being Rasputin, the charismatic holy man who we know advised both Nicholas and Alexandra, and especially became active in the court and advising Alexandra while Nicholas was away. Many people viewed him as nothing but a debauched opportunist, not even a truly religious figure, and yet, as we know, Nicholas saw him as a voice of God and even a voice of the common people. Not surprisingly, this continued carnage at the front, the heightened economic suffering at the rear, and this political rigidity by the Tsar's government contributed to reviving and intensifying a civic protest. Most ominously, given where they were located near the centers of power, we see this among the urban lower classes. Already, in fact, in 1915, discontent, especially with economic conditions, was leading to a growing strike movement, notwithstanding the fact that strikes were illegal during the time of war, and workers knew that they could be sent to the front simply for going out on strike. The main issues in these strikes were economic. Indeed, they were about fundamental survival, wages enough to afford supplies, and simply demands for food, that somehow the stores have goods that they could buy and afford. Increasingly, though, workers began to make political demands, saying we needed an end to the war causing these problems. We need a democratic government where people's voices could be heard. We need greater freedom. In other words, demands to change the conditions, the political conditions, leading to their material, their economic suffering. Strikes, in fact, were the most visible sign of this deepening anger of the Russian poor. For example, we know that agents of the secret police who lived and worked among various classes of the Russian population were by 1916 reporting to the central government, and I know this from secret reports that I find in the archives. They were reporting numerous signs by 1916 of a looming explosion. They described meetings going on around factories in which speakers got up and complained about economic conditions and the lack of a democratic government. They report seething anger on bread lines, mostly women standing on these lines, working class women standing for hours waiting for bread, sometimes faced with a closed shop by the time they got to the head of the line, and often having to endure extremely cold conditions while waiting in line. They report growing readiness by lower-class Russians to read subversive leaflets and proclamations by all sorts of radical parties and unions and committees, all of which were often illegally reviving during the war. They report assaults on businesses, especially food shops. Sometimes women and workers couldn't stand it when the shop closed, and they simply smashed its windows and destroyed everything inside. They report appearance of guns in the hands of workers. And also numerous muggings and robberies and suicides and fires, all of which the secret police suggested were signs of a breakdown of order. In fact, by the fall of 1916, the situation had gotten so bad that even Nicholas II recognized, at least briefly in a letter he sent to Alexandra in September 20th of 1916, he says the people are beginning to starve and that this posed political dangers. Socialists, of course, tried to push this discontent in a political direction. Socialist parties and organizations were all suppressed at the beginning of the war, and therefore they, in fact, could offer little direction. They were only beginning to rebuild, and only illegally as the course of the war went on. And yet there were thousands of socialist party members, even if their organizations were now suppressed and weak, who were present in factories and on the streets, who did what they could to convince workers that it was politics that was behind their suffering. It's also worth saying that educated upper class and middle class liberals also began to mobilize in protest, though mostly, as on the eve of 1905, with words. Liberals continue to urge that at a time of crisis such as this war, the nation should be united. And the way to do this, it argued, from the very beginning of the war, liberals were making this argument, that the government should establish what they like to call a government of national confidence. In other words, appoint ministers who liberals and society respected, who would work closely with civic organizations and with the Duma, the elected parliament. And in fact, to strengthen these efforts, during the summer of 1915, a special bloc of Duma, of parliamentary deputies, was formed called the Progressive Bloc. It represented a large majority of Duma deputies from multiple parties, liberal parties, the Oktoberists, the Cadets, and others. And their main demand was this one, a government of national confidence that would have the confidence of the public. And it's worth saying the government was not entirely deaf to these appeals. They recognized the severity of the crisis. In the fall of 1915 already, the Council of Ministers, the cabinet chosen by Nicholas II, expressed to Nicholas II their collective desire to work out a compromise with the Duma, to actually collectively resign and form a new cabinet that would indeed have the confidence of liberal society and of the country as a whole. Nicholas, rather typically, tragically perhaps, rejected this demand, and instead, in fact, he ordered the Duma prorogued, temporarily closed for their effrontery in continuing to demand a government of national confidence. When this decision by the Tsar was reported to the cabinet, to the Council of Ministers that had been appealing for some sort of compromise at a meeting on September 2nd, 1915, the foreign minister, a man named Sergei Sazonov, declared that he felt political upheaval was now inevitable. This is already in 1915. He said, "Tomorrow, blood will flow in the streets and Russia will plunge into the abyss." His prediction was, in fact, premature. But it is plausible to argue that had Nicholas II at this point conceded to the moderate demands of the Duma, indeed to the advice of his own ministers, the coming revolution might have been avoided, or at least its fury abated. Of course, it could have been worse. Nicholas, in fact, chose to ignore his wife's advice. She suggested that all the liberal members of the Duma, which were a majority, be sent to Siberia as traitors. Still, he wouldn't budge from his commitment to the ideal of the Tsar's divine, personal, unlimited power as the only source of salvation for Russia. Of course, it's worth saying that had the Tsar conceded and created a government of national confidence, many liberals were already probably likely not to have been satisfied with this. As the war dragged on and discontent grew, many liberals began to speak not of a government of national confidence, but of a responsible government, a government that, in fact, wasn't just considerate of the interests of the Duma, but in fact was controlled by the elected representatives of parliament. There was institutional control that was accountable to the Duma. Faced with this obstinacy of Nicholas II, even many conservative, even many monarchists sought to halt the seemingly now inevitable approach of revolution by forcing reform. In fact, there was serious talk of a palace coup in high social circles in 1916. The Grand Dukes were beginning to think perhaps Nicholas ought to be overthrown. Monarchist members of the State Council, this important advisory body to the Tsar, of the greatest elite, began to talk about the same. Aristocratic salons began to talk about perhaps it was necessary for there be a palace coup. Even officers had the same conversation. The only practical echo of this, though, was the murder of Rasputin in December of 1916, the result of a conspiracy involving very high-born and highly placed individuals. A nobleman and a leading rightist politician of the Duma was one of these members. A prince related by marriage to the imperial family was another conspirator, and even one of Nicholas II's own cousins. Mainly, though, these conservatives begged Nicholas to make political changes and warned, if not, a terrible revolution was certain. In the months that followed, liberals in the press and in the Duma, which was reconvened toward the end of 1916, continued to criticize the government with increasing passion and even hostility, desperate in the face of this growing crisis. But they feared doing anything more than speaking. They called, one of the leaders of the Duma called for a war of words, but he made it clear that only words could be used legally. And the problem was they were trapped, as liberals, by their political logic into a sort of frustrated immobility. They understood that that terrible upheaval was certain if nothing was done. But as liberals, they were committed to the principles of legality and therefore opposed in principle any sort of revolutionary action. They were also justifiably afraid, if they took bold action, of provoking a much more dangerous revolution in the streets. They all remembered 1905. In fact, some members of the Duma felt rather trapped and even powerless. In fact, as one wrote in a letter, a private letter, but seized by the political police, hence I could find it in the archive, just days before the revolution actually happened, in February of 1917, he wrote, the deputies of the Duma wander around like emaciated flies. Nobody believes in anything. Everyone has lost heart. Everyone feels and knows their powerlessness. The situation is hopeless. And as in 1905, the liberals' hands, their hesitancy, was forced. They were forced to do more than talk and worry when a lower class upheaval finally, inevitably, really, broke out in the streets. This began February 23rd, 1917, which was March 8th. In Western Europe, which was International Women's Day, hence in Russia as well. And on this day, thousands of women textile workers, especially in Petrograd, shut down their factories and appealed to anybody still working to join them in the streets. The main focus of their strike was bread. Bread had become the symbolic focus of all their protests. The devastations of inflation, the widespread shortages of fuel and clothing and food, anger over the war, anger over government policy, deep distrust of the rich and the powerful, all seem to coalesce around a single outrage, the lack of bread. Huge crowds marched through the streets shouting, "Give us bread." Crowds began to head towards city centers, and it's clear from police reports they were in a nasty mood. Demonstrators along the way toward the center began breaking store windows, knocking trams over, and continually calling everybody who was still working out onto the streets. During the next couple of days, encouraged by hundreds of socialist activists who were working in factories and neighborhoods, this strike spread throughout the city. By the 25th of February, the 10th of March, and the rest of the world, the entire city of Petrograd, the capital city, was shut down. And the demands of the demonstrators gradually, in fact, almost immediately,